Imagine your brain is just utterly convinced that you are in mortal danger.
Right.
Like it is
Oof.
sounding this blaring, inescapable fire alarm, flooding your body with adrenaline and just screaming at you to run for your life.
Yeah, full fight or flight.
Exactly. But now imagine that exact alarm goes off in the very moment you're trying to be, you know, intimately close, like physically connected and vulnerable with the person you love most in the world.
It is, it's a profound neurological paradox, really. The body is desperately trying to survive a threat that the conscious mind, well, it knows perfectly well, isn't actually
Right,
there, though.
because you're just in your own bedroom. And on the other side of that paradox is a partner.
Yeah.
A partner who is deeply in love, biologically primed for connection and completion. And suddenly they're faced with this abrupt, completely involuntary halt to the intimacy.
It's incredibly jarring.
It is. So today we are doing a deep dive into this this collision of two highly sensitive, intensely real experiences within long-term romantic partnerships.
And it's a topic that mostly sits behind closed doors.
Oh, completely. It's shrouded in just a massive amount of silence and, frankly, mutual guilt.
We're looking at the really intricate dynamics that unfold when a female partner who is a survivor of childhood sexual trauma experiences a physiological trigger during sex.
And the male partner, who consequently faces the, you know, the psychological and emotional toll of involuntarily interrupted arousal.
Right. We've pulled together an extensive stack of research for you today to unpack this.
Yeah, we're drawing from clinical psychology literature on complex trauma, some really cutting-edge somatic therapy research, and relational studies too.
Specifically, studies that examine the neurobiological and psychological impacts of interrupted sexual arousal in men.
Right. We are looking at the brain, we're looking at the body, and that incredibly fragile space between two people who are just trying to navigate this together.
But before we get into the actual mechanisms of this, I think we really need to establish a firm boundary around what we are and are not analyzing today.
Yes, the ground rules. Let's make this crystal clear for everyone listening. We are emphatically not talking about intentionally interrupted sex as like a lifestyle choice.
Exactly.
This is not a deep dive into tantric pacing or semen retention practices or any voluntary consensual choice to delay climax for extended pleasure.
Right, because those practices are built on mutual intention. It's a shared conscious goal.
Right.
What we are examining today is strictly the dynamic of involuntary interruption.
Meaning the moment a trauma trigger hijacks the nervous system.
Yes, necessitating an immediate, completely non-negotiable halt to physical intimacy.
So our focus is on the fallout of that specific moment, like how both partners can survive it, how they can offer mutual support,
Right.
and crucially, and I think this is the most important part, how they can actually build a deeper, more resilient intimacy because of it.
Rather than in spite of it.
Exactly. So to even begin to understand the friction that happens in the bedroom, I feel like we have to rewind the clock.
We do. We have to look at the invisible psychological barriers that are being carried into that space.
Barriers that were constructed long, long before this couple ever even met each other.
If we look at the developmental psychology sources we gathered, they show that childhood sexual trauma fundamentally rewrites a person's internal blueprint for how they perceive their own sexual identity.
It alters the foundational architecture of the mind, right?
It really does.
The clinical literature uses a phrase I found really compelling for this. They call them sexual self schemas.
Yes, schemas.
And when I was reading through the papers, I started thinking about schemas just as everyday mental shortcuts.
That's a great way to think about it.
Like, okay, I have schema for going to a restaurant. I walk in, a host seats me, I look at a menu, I order, I eat, I pay.
Right, the script.
Exactly. The entire script is pre-written in my brain, so I don't have to consciously relearn how a restaurant works every single time I get hungry.
That is a perfect baseline. A schema is basically a cognitive framework that helps us organize and interpret vast amounts of information efficiently.
Right.
But what happens if you walk into that restaurant, sit down, and the waiter hands you like a pile of raw ingredients and tells you to cook it yourself in the middle of the dining room?
I mean, I would freeze. My brain would completely glitch because the reality in front of me is, well, it's violating the script my brain relies on.
Precisely. So now let's map that concept onto sexuality. A sexual self schema is the complex mental framework governing how a person perceives their sexuality, their body, and the very act of intimacy itself.
Okay.
For someone who grows up in a healthy, secure environment, their developing schema naturally associates physical closeness with emotional intimacy.
Like pleasure, connection, and feeling safe while being vulnerable.
Exactly. Mutual safe vulnerability.
But the trauma we are talking about today happens during a critical developmental window. So it takes that blueprint and completely shreds it.
Well, it doesn't just shred it. It actively rewrites it with what clinicians call maladaptive cognitive associations.
Meaning it wires things together that shouldn't be together.
Right. When childhood sexual trauma occurs, the developing brain is subjected to extreme stress and a profound violation of boundaries. And the brain's primary job, above all else, is survival.
So it's trying to protect the child.
Yes. In a brilliant but ultimately tragic attempt to protect the individual in the future, it rewrites the sexual schema.
Wow.
Instead of associating vulnerability with connection, the brain inextricably wires it to fear, deep-seated shame, pain, and a terrifying loss of control.
It's like trying to navigate this sprawling, beautiful new city with your partner.
Yeah.
But the only map you have was drawn by someone who violently crossed out all the parks, the cafes, and the museums.
Yeah.
And they just wrote lethal danger across the entire grid.
That's exactly what it feels like. You want to explore the city. You want to enjoy the relationship. But every time you try to step out of the hotel, your map is screaming at you that you are literally walking into an ambush. And the tragedy of that map is that it forces the survivor to operate from a place of global mistrust.
Global mistrust.
Yeah, meaning it is rarely a conscious mistrust of her specific loving partner in the present day. It is a profound, generalized mistrust of the state of vulnerability itself.
Not dicey.
The cognitive schema dictates that emotional closeness is always the precursor to harm.
So even when her partner is doing everything right, like, you know, setting up a romantic evening, being gentle, creating a really loving environment, her brain isn't interpreting those actions as love.
No, not at all. Her brain interprets that closeness as a massive red flag.
Because in her formative experience, closeness equaled danger.
Exactly. The person who was supposed to be safe or the environment that was supposed to be protected was actually the source of the abuse.
Right.
So the adult brain is acting as a proactive shield. It preemptively short-circuits the ability to form a secure emotional bond in that moment to prevent a repeat of the historical trauma.
And I imagine this makes communication just nearly impossible in the early stages of a relationship. I mean, if your brain is telling you that intimacy is a trap, how do you even begin to articulate your boundaries?
You often don't, or you simply can't. The sources show that this cognitive imprint causes immense struggle with expressing boundaries.
Like they just shut down.
Yes. The female partner might completely freeze when intimacy is initiated. She might avoid any conversations about sex, even entirely outside the bedroom, like in the middle of the afternoon.
Just because of the anxiety.
Because of the sheer weight of the shame attached to her schema. This means the couple might never even get a chance to sit down and look at her map before they find themselves completely lost and terrified in the middle of that city.
So she is carrying this immense, invisible psychological weight. Her own mind is actively fighting her desire for a safe, intimate connection.
It is.
But as the research clearly emphasizes, trauma doesn't just stay locked in the filing cabinets of the mind. It bleeds out into the physical form.
This is a really critical transition in our understanding of the sources. We have to move from the psychological to the biological.
Okay.
Trauma lives in the nervous system. The chronic stress of early abuse leads to a chronic dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system.
Right. Let's break down the autonomic nervous system, because this is where we stop talking about abstract thoughts and start talking about hardwired biology.
Yes, the physical hardware.
This is the system that runs everything behind the scenes, right?
Yeah.
Like heart rate, digestion, breathing.
All the involuntary bodily functions. And it essentially operates on two main branches.
Okay.
You have the parasympathetic nervous system, which acts as the body's brake pedal.
The brake pedal.
Right. This is your rest and digest state. It's where your body heals, where you digest food, and where you feel socially safe.
So that's where we want to be.
Mostly, yes. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you have the sympathetic nervous system. This is the gas pedal. The classic fight or flight system designed to mobilize you for immediate action against a threat.
So logically, for a couple to engage in healthy, enjoyable intimacy, both of their nervous systems need to be firmly rooted in that parasympathetic, relaxed state.
Absolutely. Healthy sexual arousal is fundamentally dependent on a baseline of physiological safety.
You have to feel safe to let your guard down.
Yes, your body has to be relaxed enough to allow for shifts in blood flow, for muscle groups to release, and for the brain to focus on pleasurable sensations.
But for a trauma survivor, it doesn't work that way.
No, the very act of moving toward intimacy, the physical closeness, the touch, the inherent vulnerability of being unclothed, acts as a catalyst for a massive, entirely inappropriate spike in the sympathetic nervous system.
Her gas pedal basically gets slammed to the floor.
Instantly, the amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain, perceives a lethal threat.
Even though there isn't one.
It doesn't matter that her conscious, rational mind knows she is lying in bed with a loving husband of 5 years. The ancient survival-driven part of the brain takes the wheel. It floods her bloodstream with adrenaline and cortisol.
And when that happens, the biology of arousal just completely shuts down.
Huh.
I mean, if your body thinks it's about to be attacked by a predator, it is not going to prioritize digesting lunch
Quack.
or
Okay.
sexual arousal. It diverts all the blood flow away from the pelvic region and sends it to the major muscle groups in the arms and legs so she can fight or run away.
That is exactly what happens on a biological level. It is a literal physiological hijacking. And this is vital for partners to understand.
Why is that so vital?
Because her body is doing exactly what millions of years of evolution designed it to do, protect the organism from perceived danger. The tragedy is that it is reacting to a ghost from the past, not the reality of the present.
And this
Yeah.
physiological hyperarousal blocks the natural experience of connection. And that manifests as very real, very physical sexual dysfunction, right?
Yes,
And
unfortunately.
clinical texts detail this extensively. We see a sudden, complete lack of desire, a physical inability to become aroused, and frequently severe physical pain during intercourse.
Clinically, we call that dyspareunia. If your sympathetic nervous system is preparing you to fight for your life, it is going to intensely clench every muscle in your body to create this armor of tension.
Which includes the pelvic floor.
Yes, that includes the pelvic floor muscles. When those muscles spasm and tighten involuntarily, any physical penetration becomes acutely painful.
Which creates just the most brutal feedback loop imaginable. She wants to be intimate, her body hits the panic button, her muscles lock up, the physical act causes actual pain.
Exactly.
And now that pain has just provided brand new physical evidence to her brain that her traumatized schema was right all along.
Exactly. The pain confirms the brain's baseline assumption. See, I told you sex was dangerous and harmful.
Wow.
This inevitably leads to intense anticipatory anxiety before the next encounter.
Which just makes it worse.
Right, because that anxiety guarantees the sympathetic nervous system will spike even faster next time, ensuring more pain, which leads to more avoidance. It profoundly disconnects the woman from her physical self.
It must just destroy her body image.
She develops a deeply negative body image. But not necessarily based on aesthetics, right? It's based on betrayal. She feels like her own body is sabotaging her deepest desire to connect with her partner.
She is trapped in a body that refuses to let her love the way she wants to. And this brings us to the breaking point in our scenario. The fire alarm is ringing, the pelvic floor is locked, the pain is real, the panic is overwhelming, and she has to stop the encounter.
She has no choice.
She has to pull the ripcord and halt the intimacy immediately for her own psychological and physical safety. But there are two people in this bed.
Yes, and we must now pivot to the other side of that bed.
Right, the partner.
We have to look at the male partner's reality with the exact same level of clinical objectivity and empathy. When the female partner's trauma response necessitates this involuntary, sudden halt to intimacy, what exactly happens to the man?
Well, according to the relational studies and the neurobiological literature we reviewed, the buildup of sexual arousal in men is not just some light physical friction.
No, not at all.
It is a deeply intertwined, escalating process of physical sensations and an immense neurochemical cascade.
During arousal, a man's central nervous system is rapidly accelerating. His brain is being flooded with dopamine, which is the primary neurotransmitter for reward and motivation, and oxytocin, the bonding hormone.
So his whole system is revving up.
The entire biological machinery is escalating toward a climax that is evolutionarily designed to resolve that massive buildup of tension.
So when they are in the middle of this, when he is riding this massive neurochemical wave, and the encounter is involuntarily stopped right before that climax, I mean, it's not just a minor inconvenience. It's not
Yeah.
like pausing a movie to go get a snack.
No, it is a significant biological and psychological event. When the cycle of emotional and physical release is abruptly broken, it generates an intense amount of frustration, psychological dissatisfaction, and palpable physical tension.
Where does all that energy go?
Well, the physical energy generated during arousal doesn't just vanish because the activity stopped. It requires a significant mental and physiological effort to manage when left unresolved.
Think about it mechanically. It's like revving a high-performance sports car engine all the way to the red line. The RPMs are screaming.
Right.
But instead of shifting gears and letting the car fly down the track to release that energy, you just slam the transmission into park while your foot is still on the gas.
That's a great visual.
The engine doesn't explode, the pistons don't physically shatter, but the immense kinetic energy has absolutely nowhere to go, so the entire frame of the car just shakes violently.
That analogy captures the somatic experience perfectly. The physical impacts of unresolved arousal, what is commonly referred to colloquially as blue balls or pelvic vasocongestion, are generally mild and entirely reversible.
Right, it's not a medical emergency.
Exactly. The body will eventually reabsorb the localized fluids. It is not physically damaging in the long term, but the mental weight, the psychological energy required to force that shaking engine back down to an idle, is incredibly taxing.
He is left managing astronomical levels of unresolved dopamine and physical tension without the neurochemical release valve of climax. And that taxes his nervous system, creating a state of heightened sympathetic activity for him too.
It really does.
It manifests as severe irritability, restlessness, and this deep lingering sense of psychological dissatisfaction.
Because his body was biologically promised a resolution. His brain mapped out the trajectory of the encounter, and then the track just abruptly ended. He has to somehow process the sudden, jarring absence of that climax.
And here is the truly agonizing part. He is having to process this massive neurochemical frustration while simultaneously trying to be a compassionate, supportive partner.
To the woman he loves.
Right, who is currently crying or dissociating next to him because she's experiencing a severe trauma response. The psychological pressure cooker he is in at that exact moment is almost unfathomable.
It is a profound relational crucible. Which brings us to the collision. We have these two intense, entirely valid, conflicting realities crashing into each other.
Her trauma-induced, absolute biological mandate to stop colliding head-on with his neurobiological and psychological drive for completion.
Let's look at what this collision does to the relationship over time, say on a random Tuesday night. They try to be intimate, the trigger happens, they stop, the physical act is over. What happens in the silence that follows?
Well, this is where the communication gaps create devastating relationship-eroding misunderstandings.
Let's look at how men are generally socialized to experience intimacy. For many men, sexual connection is their primary, sometimes only, avenue for deep emotional closeness, vulnerability, and validation.
It is how they feel loved. So when the encounter is abruptly stopped, his dopamine-flooded brain doesn't immediately default to a purely clinical assessment. He doesn't lie there and think, yes, this is her maladaptive childhood schema, temporarily dysregulating her autonomic nervous system.
No, of course not. His brain interprets the sudden withdrawal of intimacy as a personal rejection. He feels the physical halt and translates it into an emotional truth. She doesn't want me. I am not desirable. I am doing something wrong.
Which is so heartbreaking.
And over time, the lack of climax and the repeated abrupt stops chip away at his foundational self-esteem.
And as this pattern repeats week after week, month after month, the nature of their sexual relationship mutates.
It changes completely.
It goes from being an intimate, shared, joyful exploration to a purely functional, highly anxious, and perpetually incomplete act.
He develops his own form of anticipatory anxiety. He starts going into the encounter expecting to be rejected.
So he might try to speed things up.
Yes, he might rush through foreplay, unconsciously trying to race to the finish line before her trauma trigger can activate, which ironically makes her feel pressured and less safe.
Thus accelerating her trigger.
Exactly.
It's a tragic dance. He misinterprets her sudden freeze or her quiet request to stop as emotional withdrawal. He feels deeply rejected and physically frustrated. And on her side, she is incredibly hypervigilant.
She feels everything.
She can feel his frustration. She can sense the tension radiating off him in the bed. She feels the shaking engine. And her trauma schema misinterprets his biological frustration as a literal threat to her safety.
Because her cognitive map explicitly states that male anger or frustration is dangerous. It precedes violence or abuse. So when he sighs in frustration or rolls over to manage his physical discomfort, she feels profoundly unsafe.
She feels pressured.
She feels pressured, and above all, she feels an overwhelming, crushing sense of guilt for failing him as a partner.
If you are looking at this from the outside, you just want to shake him and say, you love each other, just turn on the lamp and talk about it.
Yeah.
Why do couples suffer in this specific silence for years, sometimes decades?
The clinical texts point to one dominant, paralyzing emotion, shame.
Ah, shame.
It is a compounding, suffocating mutual shame that locks them both in solitary confinement. She carries the profound shame of her trauma responses. She feels broken, defective, or inadequate as a woman and a partner. She feels her body is a burden on the man she loves.
And his shame is equally complex. He knows she's a trauma survivor. He knows the horrific things she endured. He knows he should be unconditionally understanding and infinitely patient.
Yes.
So when he feels anger, physical frustration, or rejection because he didn't climax, he experiences intense guilt for having those biological feelings. He feels like a monster for caring about his own orgasm when she is actively suffering a trauma flashback.
Precisely. He feels his biological needs make him selfish or unsupportive, so neither of them speaks. They suffer their own private agonies in the exact same bed.
Resentment builds quietly in the dark.
And the bedroom transforms from a sanctuary into a minefield where both of them are terrified of taking a wrong step.
But this deep dive isn't just about admiring the architecture of the problem. It is about deconstructing it. The research provides actionable, highly effective, evidence-based solutions for navigating this exact minefield.
Let's start with how the female partner can reclaim control over her body and fulfill that fundamental need for safety.
To understand the physiological solution, we have to explore polyvagal theory. Developed by Dr. Stephen Porges, this theory has revolutionized modern trauma therapy.
It maps out how our autonomic nervous system evaluates risk and safety in our environment.
Okay, let's really break down polyvagal theory because it's the key to everything we're about to discuss.
Porges identified that the nervous system doesn't just have two gears, fight, flight, or rest, digest. It actually operates in a hierarchy of three states.
Three states?
Yes. At the very bottom is the dorsal vagal state, which is the freeze response, the immobilization. It's when the system is so overwhelmed it just shuts down.
Okay.
In the middle is the sympathetic state, the fight or flight mobilization we talked about earlier.
The gas pedal.
Right. And at the top is the ventral vagal state.
The ventral vagal state. What does that actually look and feel like for a person?
The ventral vagal state is the biological state of social engagement, safety, and connection. When you are in this state, your heart rate is steady, your breathing is deep and rhythmic, your facial muscles are relaxed, your vocal tone is melodic, and you feel genuinely connected to the people around you.
It sounds so peaceful.
It is the absolute physiological prerequisite for healthy intimacy. You cannot connect if you are not in ventral vagal.
So the million-dollar question is, when she is triggered during intimacy, when she gets thrown into the sympathetic fight or flight, or drops into the dorsal freeze, how does she manually transition her nervous system back up to that ventral vagal state of safety?
The clinical literature highlights several highly effective somatic modalities. The core principle is that you cannot think your way out of a physiological trauma response. You have to use the body to heal the body.
Makes sense.
One of the primary approaches is somatic experiencing, or SE, developed by Peter Levine.
Right, because traditional talk therapy might actually just re-trigger her by forcing her to recount the horrific details of the abuse. SE takes a totally different route.
Completely different. SE focuses almost entirely on tracking bodily sensations in the present moment.
What does tracking look like?
It teaches the survivor to notice the physical buildup of tension, the tightening of the chest, the shallow breathing, the clenching of the jaw, and to find highly specific ways to gently discharge that trapped survival energy without becoming overwhelmed.
So instead of analyzing why she is panicked, she's analyzing where the panic lives in her body right now.
Exactly. Another integrated approach is sensorimotor psychotherapy, which combines those physical tracking techniques with emotional regulation strategies.
Right.
But let's get very granular about the specific, immediate interventions she can use in the actual moment the trigger occurs in the bedroom. A foundational tool across all these therapies is controlled diaphragmatic breathing.
I really want to unpack diaphragmatic breathing, because I think a lot of people hear the phrase, just take a deep breath, and they instantly dismiss it as cheap psychological advice, like someone just telling you to calm down.
It sounds cliche.
But the research shows this is purely mechanical.
It is entirely mechanical, and it is fascinating. The vagus nerve is the superhighway of the parasympathetic nervous system. It is a massive cranial nerve that runs from your brainstem down through your neck into your chest, wrapping around your heart and lungs, and passing right through your diaphragm down into your gut.
So it physically connects the brain's fear center to the body's vital organs.
Yes. When you engage in deep, slow, diaphragmatic breathing, meaning you are breathing so deeply that your belly expands outward, physically pulling the diaphragm muscle downward, you are mechanically massaging and stimulating that vagus nerve.
You are literally reaching inside your own body and pulling the biological lever that controls your panic.
That is exactly what you are doing. When the vagus nerve is stimulated through the diaphragm, it acts as a biological brake. It sends afferent chemical signals straight up the superhighway to the brain, specifically telling the amygdala to stand down. It releases acetylcholine, which physically forces the heart rate to slow and blood pressure to drop.
So we aren't talking about thinking happy thoughts or visualizing a peaceful beach. We are talking about literal, hardwired neurobiological hacks to manually override the body's alarm system.
It gives so much agency back to the survivor.
It really does. It is incredibly empowering.
Alongside breathing, our sources emphasize grounding techniques. When a trauma trigger hits, the brain often attempts to dissociate. It tries to pull the mind away from the physical present because it is convinced the present is actually the traumatic past happening all over again.
Right.
Grounding is the practice of violently forcing the brain to stay here, in the now.
The sources mentioned using tactile textures or extreme temperatures. How exactly does holding a piece of ice stop a trauma flashback?
It comes down to the brain's limited processing bandwidth. When the panic starts rising, the amygdala is consuming massive amounts of energy running the fear program.
Right, it's hijacked the system.
If the woman reaches over to the nightstand and grabs an ice cube, the intense, freezing, novel sensory input of the ice demands the brain's immediate attention. It forces the somatosensory cortex to process the acute physical sensation happening in her hand in real time.
The brain literally can't process the phantom trauma of the past while it is being forced to process the freezing cold of the present.
Precisely. By focusing intensely on the temperature of the ice, or by aggressively gripping a highly textured blanket, she is providing undeniable physical proof to her nervous system that she is in her bedroom in the present day and the abuse is not happening right now.
She anchors herself in the safety of the current environment, breaking the dissociative loop.
It short circuits the panic.
So the female partner has these incredibly powerful tools. She's doing this brave, exhausting biological work to regulate her own nervous system. But she isn't alone. Which brings us to the final, most crucial piece of the puzzle. Bridging the gap. How do they apply these techniques together? How do they protect his fragile self-esteem, manage his profound physical frustration, and ensure her absolute safety at the exact same time?
This introduces the clinical concept of a co-regulated environment. We are fundamentally mammalian creatures. Our nervous systems are not isolated silos. They are designed to interact with, read, and regulate one another.
They're like contagions of emotion.
Exactly. Think about a mother soothing a crying infant. The mother uses her calm nervous system to bring the baby's panic nervous system back to baseline.
So if one partner is in a state of severe panic, the other partner's nervous system will instinctively sense that distress and likely escalate into sympathetic arousal as well.
Yes, through the action of mirror neurons and subtle cues like breathing rate and muscle tension. But conversely, if one partner can remain firmly anchored in a state of calm ventral vagal safety, they can act as a biological tether.
They can pull the other one back.
They can help bring the panicked partner down. Both individuals in the relationship must commit to maintaining physiological safety, which requires immense emotional maturity.
Okay, I have to push back here on behalf of anyone listening who has actually lived this. Because understanding the biology is great and knowing about co-regulation is great, but practically speaking, how do they do this without building massive resentment?
It's hard.
Right. The man is sitting there with his engine redlining, remember? He is physically uncomfortable and psychologically frustrated.
The absolute necessity here, and the literature is unanimous on this, is the establishment of radically open, transparent dialogue regarding motivations, boundaries, and physiological feelings.
And this dialogue must, at first, happen entirely outside the bedroom, in a completely non-sexual context.
Like a Sunday afternoon walk or sitting at the kitchen table with coffee.
They cannot try to have this nuanced conversation while one of them is dissociating and the other is flooded with dopamine.
Exactly. The man's patience and empathy are critical for her healing, yes. But he also desperately needs a safe, designated space to voice his own psychological frustrations without being made to feel like a monster.
He needs to be able to say, "When we stop abruptly, I feel deeply rejected and physically agitated."
And she needs to be in a grounded enough state to hear that without her trauma schema instantly translating his words into, "He is angry, he is going to hurt me, I am in danger."
Precisely. They have to establish communication protocols long before the clothes ever come off. They need a pre-established language for the crisis moment.
When she freezes, she shouldn't have to expend precious cognitive energy trying to explain her complex trauma history to him while she is hyperventilating.
They need a shorthand.
They might agree on a specific safe word or even a nonverbal cue, like two quick squeezes of his hand.
Oh, that's smart.
That simple pre-agreed action communicates a massive amount of information instantly. It tells him, "This is the trauma responding. The fire alarm just went off. My body is shutting down. This is not a rejection of you, and I need us to stop the physical act immediately."
But again, biological drives are incredibly stubborn. When the safe word is used and the physical intercourse stops, what actually happens next?
That's the pivot.
How do a couple practically redefine intimacy when his biological drive for a climax is screaming at him and her need to escape the physical touch is absolute? How do they manage the literal moment the brakes are hit?
If we connect this back to the neurochemicals we discussed earlier, it requires a conscious, radical shifting of the goalpost of sex.
What does that mean?
For the vast majority of neurotypical couples, the unspoken, culturally ingrained goal of sex is climax, specifically ejaculation. When trauma is in the room, they must consciously redefine the goal.
Where?
The goal can no longer be climax. The goal must become shared, safe connection.
Let's walk through the exact script. They are being intimate. The alarm goes off. She uses the safe word or squeezes his hand. Intercourse stops immediately.
Yeah.
What do they do with his revving engine so he doesn't feel rejected and she doesn't feel guilty?
They instantly pivot from intercourse to co-regulation. They do not separate. They don't roll over to opposite sides of the bed in silence.
They stay connected.
They stay physically connected, but they shift the energy entirely. They might move to non-sexual grounding touch. He might wrap a heavy blanket around her shoulders. They might lie side by side holding hands, or if she feels safe enough, chest to chest.
And what are they doing in that posture?
They are synchronizing their nervous systems. He deliberately slows his breathing down, utilizing his own diaphragmatic breathing, and encourages her to match his pace.
Using the vagus nerve?
Yes. He uses his calm, regulated ventral vagal state to manually pull her out of her sympathetic panic.
So instead of him pulling away in frustration, which would trigger her fear of abandonment or male anger, or him forcing himself to just deal with it alone in the dark, which breeds his deep resentment, they tackle the nervous system dysregulation as a unified team.
Yes. By staying connected through non-demand touch and synchronized breathing, they're actually de-escalating his arousal slowly, smoothly, bringing the RPMs down, rather than slamming the car into park.
That makes so much sense.
And crucially, by maintaining the emotional bond, by holding him, by looking in his eyes, and verbally affirming him after the panic subsides, he still receives the oxytocin. He still gets the bonding hormone.
He doesn't get the sharp dopamine spike of a climax, but he gets the profound, deeply necessary emotional reassurance that he is loved, desired, and valued as a partner.
Exactly. They finish the encounter feeling connected, supported, and victorious over the trauma, rather than isolated, frustrated, and defeated.
That completely flips the script. It's taking what used to be a devastating failure of a physical act and transforming it into a highly successful, incredibly brave attempt at deep emotional connection. It changes the entire narrative of their relationship.
It does. It requires immense emotional maturity, unrelenting patience, and a lot of practice. But it is the only way to protect both of their realities simultaneously.
Let's pull back and look at the terrain we've covered today. We started by looking deep into the mind, understanding how childhood sexual trauma fundamentally rewrites a survivor's sexual self schemas, drawing a map that highlights danger exactly where there should be joy and connection.
And we moved into the biology of the body, exploring how the autonomic nervous system violently rebels against intimacy.
Right, triggering a sympathetic fight or flight response that shuts down physical connection and causes agonizing physical pain.
And we made sure not to look away from the male partner's reality either. We validated the genuine heavy psychological weight, the profound physical frustration, and the nervous system taxation of involuntarily interrupted sexual arousal.
We explored how easily that biological frustration can be misinterpreted as rejection, eroding his self-esteem. We saw how that specific collision can destroy intimacy and build impenetrable walls of mutual shame.
But then we looked at the incredible mechanical biological tools available to fight back.
Polyvagal theory, somatic experiencing, and the literal hack of the vagus nerve through diaphragmatic breathing and tactile grounding.
And finally, we explored how a couple can use intentional co-regulation and pre-established communication protocols to transform a moment of sheer panic into a moment of shared, safe connection, shifting the goalpost from physical climax to emotional intimacy.
As we wrap up this exploration, I want to leave you with a final paradigm shift to ponder. It's a thought that wasn't explicitly spelled out in the clinical research, but it's the logical, beautiful conclusion of everything we've unpacked today.
What is it?
What if an involuntary interruption in intimacy isn't a failure of the sexual encounter at all? What if it is an invitation?
An invitation to a completely different kind of depth.
Think about it. What if the intense communication, the radical selfless patience, and the complex somatic co-regulation required to navigate this exact challenge actually forge a level of emotional intimacy and rock-solid trust that neurotypical couples rarely, if ever, achieve?
That's a really powerful way to look at it.
The trauma is undeniably a tragic starting point. It is an incredibly unfair burden to carry. But the relationship that grows from surviving it together, from sitting in the fire as a team, holding hands, and breathing through the panic, that relationship might just be unbreakable.
That is a profound, incredibly hopeful thought to carry forward.
It is heavy work. It is deeply complex, but it is intensely real. Thank you for sitting down with us and exploring the hidden mechanics of how we connect, how we break, and how we heal. Keep asking the hard questions. Keep seeking to truly understand the people you love, and keep exploring. We'll see you next time.